Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of October. This hour of the program, the Pakistani military has launched its ground assault into Taliban's stronghold of South Waziristan. Yesterday, there was a horrible suicide bombing in Pakistan of a school. A number of students were killed and many were injured. We're going to be talking about why it is that the Pakistan has decided to launch a ground assault, how the Taliban has shocked the country with a series of devastating suicide and military assaults on the army, on police, on government and civilian targets nationwide. We'll get an update on yesterday's attack. I understand a number of schools were closed today because of what happened yesterday in Pakistan. Our guest is Bill Raggio. He's managing editor of the Long War Journal. It's dedicated to providing original and accurate reporting and analysis of the global war on terror. He's also president of Public Multimedia, an adjunct fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a media fellow at the Hoover Institute, and a contributor to the Weekly Standard. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The news yesterday, suicide bombers attacking an Islamic university popular with foreigners in Pakistan's capital yesterday, Islamabad, killing four people, and this in apparent retaliation for the escalating army offensive on a Taliban and al-Qaeda stronghold near the Afghan border. We will be welcoming phone calls and emails to talk@WPR.org is our address for your email, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Bill. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Tell me what you know about yesterday's suicide bombers at this Islamic university. First, why would you target a university? And I also heard from news reports that they've closed a number of schools in Pakistan today because of this.
Yeah, actually, you know, most, I believe, if not all of the schools in Pakistan have been closed down today. That's just the severity of the attack. And not a lot of people killed, but what you had happen was two suicide bombers, one believed to be a woman, it may be the second female suicide bomber in the last week. The supposed female suicide bomber walked into a woman's cafeteria at this university. It's about 17,000 people, about 2,000 of them from around the world. There's about 6,000 women that attend this university. And then another suicide bomber attacked a men's faculty where they discussed Sharia or Islamic law. The reasons for these attacks, well, the Taliban don't, you know, while we sit here and scratch our head, how could they attack their fellow Muslims? How could they do this? That's not the way the Taliban sees it. I mean, women don't go to school. You know, that's the way the Taliban see it. So attacking them, they're just as bad as infidels. They're not considered Muslims. And in the case of the Sharia, the classroom that was attacked, or was a sort of a faculty, I believe, in the same case, I mean, there apparently a very moderate version of Sharia law was being preached there. Well, the Taliban, you know, they practice the most extreme forms of that. So, you know, they're going right to the heart. They're not just striking in Pakistan at the military. They're going after the government. They're going after the religious institutions. They're trying to assert their dominance throughout Pakistan.
Is it unusual for the Taliban to be engaged in suicide bombing?
Oh, no, absolutely not. They do them, just about every other day as of late. And last year they conducted, I think it was around 60 or 70 suicide bombs, suicide attacks last year, another 50 or 60 this year. I've lost count, to be honest with you, sadly. But it's, this is what the Taliban does. They admit it. They take credit for these attacks.
Mm-hmm. This also came, there have been so many attacks. There was a raid on Army headquarters, leaving 23 people dead. Five UN World Food Program workers were killed when another suicide bomber detonated his explosives in their office. So their attacks have, as a result, I would imagine, of what the Army is doing and really taking some action here, finally, the Pakistani Army, this is in retribution for that?
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of sad. I mean, the country has been under siege by the Taliban for years now. The Taliban have taken over a good swath of the northwestern Pakistan. As of last spring, it was around 11% of Pakistan total that the Taliban controlled. This is overt control, too, not like, you know, in a lot of areas, in places in southern Punjab and in areas in Karachi and other in Lahore. the Taliban, you know, they pretty much rule, you know, in the sense that they're not even touched. So, you know, the military was talking about conducting an operation in South Waziristan. This is one of the hubs of the Taliban activities. This is, you know, the Taliban home base. But it's not the only place where the Taliban is active. But yeah, they did. They were sort of dithering over whether they should go into South Waziristan or not. They were even saying, well, we'll do it next spring. And this is while suicide attacks were, you know, hitting in Islamabad at the World Food Program, which shut that program down as well. Mm. And so, you know, and after that assault on General Headquarters, the military really couldn't wait any longer. And it's kind of, you know, it really speaks volumes about the situation in Pakistan that they have to be forced to go after the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. So they should have done this a long time ago?
Yeah, they should have. And, you know, and they pretended that they were doing this a long time ago. There's been three other operations in South Waziristan, and they've all failed miserably. You know, literal defeats for the Pakistani military, and they had to sign humiliating peace agreements. So, you know, and I don't really think they put all their effort into it. I don't think they had the political will, and I don't think the military wanted to do it. But regardless, this, you know, the fact that this problem has spiraled to this far out of control, you know, there's a lot of factors involved in that, and a lot of that is within the military and intelligence establishment there, a lot of sympathy for the Taliban.
Tell me about these series of peace agreements. You describe them as humiliating peace agreements in an effort to keep the Taliban at bay that Pakistan has signed with some factions of the Taliban.
Yeah, these agreements, in the past, what they've done was the military would go and negotiate these agreements with usually with the provincial government, Northwest Frontier Provinces, one of four major provinces in Pakistan. They would go with the Taliban and say, hey, look, here's a deal. We'll not attack you. We'll withdraw our troops from your areas, and all you have to do is not attack us. And then what this would do, and then they would make up some, well, you know, you guys can't shelter, the Taliban can't shelter foreign fighters, and you can't set up a parallel administration. All these things that the Taliban immediately broke as soon as they walked away from the negotiation tables. So, you know, it was this real farce that the government, it was sort of a nod and a wink. The government would say, hey, we'll stop fighting and pretend that we cut a deal with our brothers here in the tribal areas, and the Taliban would just continue to consolidate their power. This happened from, the problem really became apparent and really metastasized in 2006, and just worsened over the last several years. And the last one was in Swat. That's when the military was forced to launch this operation in Swat when the Taliban overreached and they took over a district. I think a district is like a county here in the United States, and a province is like a state. So they took over a district that was adjacent to Islamabad, the capital of Islam of Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. You write about these different tribal agencies and different tribal groups, Taliban groups. Are there great divisions among them, Bill, or are they pretty much united?
Yeah, yes and no. There are some traditional divisions with some of the tribes. Particularly in North and South Waziristan, you have two main tribes. One's called the Masuds, and one is called the Waziris. And there's a traditional tribal rivalry there that goes back centuries. Think of sort of Hatfield and McCoy-esque. But they do, by and large, and this is done through the Haqqani family and through Al-Qaeda and through the Afghan Taliban, they do share a same vision of establishing a caliphate or, you know, an Islamic state. They cooperate together to attack U.S. and NATO and Afghan forces in Afghanistan. The Wazir side of it, they're not really for opposing the Pakistani state. They like the way things are. They focus their efforts in Afghanistan, whereas the Masuds, that's what's called the Tariqi Taliban Pakistan, or the movement for the Taliban in Pakistan. They've consolidated a whole bunch of like-minded groups throughout the Northwest, well beyond Waziristan, and they created that movement, and that's what's been launching attacks in Pakistan. So there's disagreements there, and usually they're tribal or personality based. I really, the best way, if you've ever watched The Godfather, You know, the families were always at each other's throats, but in the end of the day, they were still the mob. And I think that's the best way that we can, you know, if you want to really take a simplistic view of what the Taliban is, that's the best way you can do it.
Mm-hmm. And with the stepped up attacks lately on schools and colleges, places where you're supposed to be safe and learning and the ultimate in a supposedly a civilized society, and with attacks on the UN World Food Program, which had to shoot it had to be shut down. What is the response to people in Pakistan? Do they steel themselves and say we have to carry on with life as usual, or does it create a great amount of fear?
You know, it surprisingly, there's a lot of different reactions, and one of the main reactions is a lot of anger at the government. They blame the government for not providing security, for not taking the fight to the Taliban, or in some cases they believe that, oh, if we only didn't attack the Taliban in South Waziristan like the Americans want us to do, we'd have no problems. I mean, that's delusional. The Taliban would be attacking a Pakistani state whether the U.S. was pushing them to fight in South Waziristan or not at this stage in the game. But yeah, there's a lot of anger, and they live in fear. I mean, you see this all the time. The Taliban, one of the things they're very effective at doing in the tribal areas and in the north, the greater northwest, they target the political leaders and the, you know, also the tribal leaders that actively oppose them. So anytime these groups try to form a local militia, the Taliban just go and they assassinate anyone that is remotely involved in a leadership position. And these militias, which are called Lashkars, they just fall apart. And it causes the people to just live in fear, and they just try and get by and survive.
Bill Raggio is our guest. We're going to take phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Ray from Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment on the words that we're using to describe this fight. When our drones killed 700 innocent people, since Mr. Obama has been in office, that's the going count right now. Aren't those people's lives worth just as much as the innocents that the Taliban have killed? And we started your show reminding us of who the Taliban have killed recently. Shouldn't you have also put in the death toll, the innocent death toll? Like, for instance, in our country, if we're going to go after a mob boss, we don't blow up his entire block, all the people that live on it, just to get him. But for some reason, that's okay for us to do that in Pakistan. And I was brought up as a Christian, and I don't see anywhere in the Bible where Jesus says to kill thy enemy.
Bill.
Sure, yeah. Well, first of all, the 700 number is absolutely incorrect. I've done an in-depth study on this, me and another gentleman that writes with me. Our study, and we admittedly believe that the number is very low, but we put the number somewhere around 100. The New America Now, and I admit that, but you know, this is based on the Pakistani press reports as they came. The New American Foundation did a report. They cited our report as well. They came up with about 250 to 300 civilians killed. So what you have, the rest of them, the other 700 or so killed were Taliban fighters and Taliban commanders and Al-Qaeda leaders. You know, the second point here is, look, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't believe in a moral equivalence here. We're fighting an enemy here that goes intentionally targets civilians in schools. As we talked about here in the beginning of the program, they go into the World Food Program and blow it up. They go into schools and they blow up women and children. They blow up people in mosques and you know, anywhere that they can kill people, they will kill people. There is a very, very big difference in, you know, and in a war, you cannot fight a war civilian casualty free. It's just absolutely impossible. And this is a war. This is not a police action. We can't knock on a door in South Waziristan and say, excuse me, Mr. Massoud, can you come with me? We'd like to place you under arrest. That is just not going to happen, because the people that knock on that door will be dead in a second. You know, we are in a war, and we have to act like we're in a war. And one of the very, very unfortunate consequences of a war is that there will be civilian casualties. But one of the things I believe, and I know because I go out, I embed with the U.S. forces over there, I see the great pains they go through to prevent civilian casualties. And then I see the great the great efforts that the Taliban and al-Qaeda goes through to kill civilians.
You wrote, though, and tell me if there's a difference you think between how the U.S. is handling this and how Pakistan is handling this. And I quote you, Pakistani air and ground fire has been typically heavy-handed. Villages are often attacked indiscriminately, increasing the odds of civilian casualties.
Yeah, well, what the Pakistani military does is they just go and use the old method of warfare, which is go in and level cities. The U.S., no, and we make mistakes. Make no mistake, we have made many errors in Afghanistan and in Iraq, but, you know, errors are not the same as planning an operation and saying, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take all of our artillery and pound this town, and then we'll march in afterwards into that town, and there will be, and all the dead people will call Taliban. That's what the Pakistani government did in Swat. That's what they've done in Bajur. That's what they're going to do in South Waziristan. That's what they do. The U.S. military, when the U.S. military kills civilians in Afghanistan, they own up to it. Now, there may be disputes over those numbers, but they launch investigations, and you know, and there's a discussion over it. And occasionally people are pay the price for the mistakes. But, you know, there's a very big difference between a mistake and an investigation and again, intentionally planning something out. When was the last time we had a Taliban investigation into a suicide bombing in a mosque?
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. John from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I would like to guess just to speak to the question of the friendly and enemy Taliban forces and how that relates the report, what the source of that report is, and how that relates to the Pakistani government, whether, in fact, friendly and enemy has undertones within the Pakistani government. Thank you.
Are you referring, when you say friendly versus enemy, are you talking about the airstrikes, or I'm sorry, I don't understand the question, I guess.
John? Well, why don't you take it from your understanding of it, what you just said?
Yeah, I'm not sure what John was getting at. I mean, perhaps he was talking about killings, you know, how the... What John was referring to here was the Pakistani military killing civilians during their operations. That's what I'm going to guess here. And in that case, that really does cause a lot of problems in these areas, because one of the things these people in these areas believe is that the Pakistani government and the Pakistani military abandoned them to the Taliban. And then when they come in to free them, the Pakistani military, again, has no consideration for them and just comes in heavy-handed and kills them. And this just creates greater recruits for the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the Pakistani government did abandon them to the Taliban?
Yeah, I do. In a lot of instances, there's a lot of documented cases. In the case of Swat, the man who's the... there's a... a division is an administrative unit. It's a grouping of these districts. So this one, the commissioner for this division, he actively subverted the tribal militias in this one area called Bunar, and that's what led to the military fight. The military to take on the Taliban. He deceived them into standing down and said, "Oh, you know, we're just going to, you know, we'll have this peaceful resolution." And then about 500 Taliban fighters marched in that night and took over the entire district. So, you know, that's just one case, and I could document several others.
Bill Raggio is our guest this hour, managing editor of the Long War Journal, which is in existence to provide original and accurate reporting and analysis of the global war on terror. He's a media fellow at the Hoover Institute, a contributor to the Weekly Standard, and he has embedded with the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army, the Georgia Army, the Iraqi Army, and the Iraqi police, and with the Canadian Army in Afghanistan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. We're looking at what happened yesterday, suicide bombers attacking an Islamic university popular with foreigners in Pakistan's capital of Islamabad yesterday. We're talking about the Pakistani army offensive in Waziristan, southern Waziristan, which started just a few days ago, and looking at the retaliation for that offensive. Evidently, many, many schools are closed today. A report from Islamabad a couple hours ago, Pakistan shut many schools and colleges today because of the suicide attack on the prestigious Islamic university. So it's a mess, and we're trying to sort through all of it this hour of the program. We'll take more of your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Gail Collins will join us, columnist for the New York Times, who's written a fascinating history of what has happened to women in the United States for the past 50 years. The book is When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. You will be flabbergasted by the stories, if you didn't live through that time, of what women were experiencing in terms of in very severe discrimination as recently as 1960. All right, our number is 800-486-8655. Let's talk about the military strength here for a moment of the Taliban and also the Pakistani army, starting with the Pakistani army. Do they have a lot of troops?
Yeah, the Pakistani army, I believe, is the fourth or fifth largest army in the world. It's very large. And not just the army itself, they have a large auxiliary police forces or paramilitary forces, some called the Frontier Corps. There's about 60,000 Frontier Corps based in northwestern Pakistan alone, and then they have groups like Rangers and a whole slew of groups that could augment the regular army. One of the problems that Pakistan has is that most of their forces are arrayed against their traditional enemy, which is India. So and the Pakistanis are very hesitant to redeploy forces to the Northwest Frontier Province in order to fight the Taliban. So this current operation in South Waziristan, there's about 10,000 Taliban fighters estimated and a couple thousand Al-Qaeda and Central Asian fighters who are essentially Al-Qaeda fighters that are allied with the Taliban and are fighting. And there's about 28,000 troops. Pakistani troops that are assigned to go in there. Well, the numbers just, you run the numbers in counterinsurgency, and it's just, you know, well, to do the offensive for one and then to fight the counterinsurgency that's going to have to happen if they decide to do that, the numbers just aren't good. There's just not enough troops. They're not putting enough troops into the battle in order to defeat the Taliban. And the other problem here, another, is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, is that it's the problem is far, far bigger than North or South Waziristan. They're only going after the Taliban in one half of South Waziristan. The Pakistani military cut a peace deal with another powerful Taliban commander in the other half of South Waziristan. And by the way, our Predator strikes killed more Al-Qaeda operatives, senior Al-Qaeda operatives in this Mullah Nazir's tribal areas than he did in the other half that they're on the offensive, and the same thing in North Waziristan. And then I could go up the map, and there's a host of Taliban and Al-Qaeda sanctuaries throughout the Northwest, and they all really need to be taken down.
Mm-hmm. And how does the Taliban fight?
The Taliban, what they'll typically do is the military will come in, and they'll put up a stiff fight and hold the military off. They'll bleed them, so they'll fight real hard from fixed positions. And then when it starts getting rough, they'll melt away. And then what they'll do is lay IEDs or roadside bombs and mines, and conduct ambushes. And particularly in the terrain in the tribal areas, very mountainous terrain, and the terrain favors the defender. And in this case, this is their tribal areas. They've been fighting in these areas for centuries. They were known as fierce fighters long before they became Taliban.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to, is it Kamar from Manitowoc?
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one question and a comment. My comment is that your guest just said that the Pakistani army, in comparison with the U.S. Army, or I should say the Western forces, when Pakistan army goes in those towns, and they gave the example of Sawat, that they just go and rebel the town and bulldoze the town, and same thing they are doing in South Waziristan. And my question is that I'm not sure where he is getting that information. Why were there more than 3 million refugees in Sawat, and more than 300,000 people have left the South Waziristan? That was just because of the initial warning given weeks before the mission was started by the Pakistani army to let the civilian leave the area. That fact itself speaks for itself, and disputes the version of your guest saying that just go in and kill the people indiscriminately. Second question I would have, if you can give me information, because he says he has been in that area. Comment on the fact that where these people are getting all these arms and ammunition. Last week when the South Waziristan mission started, there were more than 6 or 7 anti-aircraft guns in South Waziristan. Has anybody, including the U.S. Army or the U.S. administration, looked into the fact where these people are getting the support from financial viewpoint as well as arms and ammunition? Why don't put the sanction on the neighboring countries who are openly helping these people, and just because of the political interests of the Western countries in particular, they are not even talking about those sources helping these terrorists there.
Yeah, on the first question concerning the internally displaced people, the vast majority, particularly in SWAT, fled while the fighting was occurring. In some cases, the Pakistani military does not go in and level towns. But there are, look, I could point you to numerous independent press reports in the Pakistani press itself that documents these cases of villagers, having their entire homes racked of civilians. I just published a video from Al Jazeera that shows how this happened in a town called Sararoga in South Waziristan just the other day. So I'm not certain where you get your information from, but I could tell you exactly where I'm getting mine. Concerning where does the Taliban get their weapons, the Taliban, this is an area, we're talking about an area of the world that has been awash in war for 3 decades. Afghanistan has been at war, we had the war against the Soviets, and then Afghanistan was in civil war, and the Taliban have always been well armed. I mean, look, Dara Adam Kell in the Orakazai Tribal Agency manufactures weapons. It's one of the largest, it's not an official manufacturing. It's not like an arms manufacturing companies there, but you can go in bazaars there and order a weapon, and they'll manufacture it by hand. This is an area that's awash in weapons. Look, there's a lot, the Pakistanis want a lot of people to believe that the United States and Britain and India are arming the Taliban. It really is not happening. I mean, this is really one of those things that I hear a lot of Pakistanis say, because they don't want to accept responsibility, that the Taliban is actually a homegrown problem that has been encouraged by Pakistan's security forces as part of its strategic depth against India, and is still being encouraged as part of its strategic depth against Afghanistan, because there are powerful elements within the ISI, within Inter Service Intelligence Agency, and within Pakistan's army that are waiting for the United States to pull out, and then they will put the Taliban back in power, because that's who they installed in power in the 1990s, and that's who they believe will be able to regain power in Afghanistan. Mm.
And where are they getting the money for their weapons? Drug sale?
A great question. I apologize for
no, it's all right.
That part. Several sources, and I just published referenced a story about this. A lot of it's just raised locally. In the case of there was just the Taliban was actually out fundraising in several districts in the Northwest Frontier Province for the South Waziristan operation. They extort money from Shia and Sikhs, other groups that they don't like. They get money from heroin and opium smuggling, and they get a lot of money from the Gulf states, from what's called the Golden Chain. These are the Saudi and Gulf financiers that are backing the jihad.
Mm-hmm. What about those refugees? How many are leaving the area, and how is Pakistan absorbing these people?
Yeah, the latest number I heard is anywhere between 100 to 170,000 people are leaving South Waziristan. The entire tribal agency has about 500,000 people or so. So we're talking about a very large percentage. The reports that I saw that, again, these are from Pakistani press reports, are saying that the people do not have facilities set up for them to take care of them. And guess who comes in and fills the void? Groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, who are banned, who are allies of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, they send in their so-called charitable organizations to provide tents and food and assistance. Oh, and by the way, while they're doing that, they're also recruiting jihadis.
Hmm. Thanks, Kamar, for your call. Rick from Toma is next. Hi, Rick.
How are you?
Okay, Rick, how are you?
You know, I'm very good. In listening to Bill this morning, you know, all these problems, you know, that apparently are not able to be solved. You know, you can't make sense out of nonsense. So why are we there? How long are we going to be there? How much money are we going to spend to fix a problem that can never be fixed?
Bill.
Yeah, well, you know, I really think that it's a good question, and I'm going to be perfectly honest. I have my doubts about how we can succeed in Afghanistan. That being said, I think we know the answer to the question of what happens if we leave. And what happened when we abandoned that area and when we refused to take a proactive stance is that we had an airplane run into the Pentagon, another downed in a field, and several buildings in the heart of Manhattan collapsed. Then we had almost $1 trillion worth of damage. So there's a cost to doing nothing, just as there is a cost, and also, how could I miss, almost 3,000 Americans killed. So, you know, there is a cost to doing nothing just as much as there's a cost to doing something. I don't know how long this problem will take to fix. I don't know what that cost is going to be. But, you know, I think that it is worth our effort to do this because, you know, if we walk away from here, not only do we just cause the state of what is left of the state of Afghanistan to collapse, but we will give Al-Qaeda and the Taliban a victory. What they did, and it'll be a very real propaganda victory as well as a military victory and for them as well, because what they did after Iraq was they switched the rhetoric because when they were riding high in Iraq, they said that Baghdad was the center of their new caliphate. This is where the center of jihad. Everyone should go in Baghdad and Iraq and fight. Well, once they took it on the chin in Iraq, they switched over to this sort of Armageddon-like prophecy within Islamic circles about the Khorasan. And the Khorasan is an area that's made up of Western Pakistan, Afghanistan, and parts of Central Asia and Iran. This is the area where we're fighting. And what that view there is that they will win their first battle in the Khorasan, and that will lead them to establish their global caliphate. Whether that's true or not, or that's nonsense or not, that will be a major recruiting boon for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and it will be a major financial boon for them as well. So, there's a lot of things to consider when we just want to throw our hands up and leave.
But on the other hand, Bill, we've been at this for 7 years. Indications are that the Taliban is just as strong, if not stronger. We're seeing horrible attacks in Pakistan. Obviously, something is off here. So we're not doing the right thing somehow, or we would have noticed, don't you think, not an elimination necessarily, but fewer people supporting the Taliban and fewer suicide bombings and fewer problems overall.
In Afghanistan or here?
No, in Afghanistan, the strength of the Taliban. The war doesn't seem to be going very well.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, this is as bad as it's been. But I think part of the problem is that we've mismanaged Afghanistan for so long. Afghanistan was a secondary consideration. You know, Iraq was the primary consideration. And I do believe that it was for a good reason. We can debate the merits of going into Iraq or not going into Iraq. I probably agree with a lot of the listeners on whether we shouldn't have. But once you commit, you have to, and you put your prestige, on the line, you have to follow through and see it through. And I also think we had a moral obligation to do so as well. And I think the same thing in Afghanistan. Iraq never looked worse than it did in late 2006, and I, you know, I was in Iraq in late 2006. It felt like we lost, and you know, and with a little effort and a refocus of strategy and resources, they were able to turn it around. I don't know that we'll have, be able to have such a dramatic change, but I do think that we can get off of our back heels and maybe start leaning a little forward in Afghanistan if we put a better effort into it. You know, we haven't even you know, we just haven't done what needs to be done in Afghanistan, which is go out there, do, you know, conduct a real counterinsurgency, provide security for the people, and try and help build an Afghan government. And that is going to take a long time. I mean, and the thing that you had in Iraq that you didn't have in Afghanistan was Iraq, you know, was a modern state that had modern institutions. We're starting from nothing in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Rick, for your call. Randolph from Madison. Hi.
Yeah, hi. A while back, you said that Afghanistan, or the problem of the Taliban, I should say, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, was a homegrown problem. And then you talked about some funding, and funding coming from the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia included. I did some history after watching a Frontline program on the Taliban, and like, where did they come from, or how were they created, and it really related back to the Wahhabi religion of Saudi Arabia during the Civil War period, after we had abandoned Afghanistan following the departure of the Soviets, after we had armed them to help them get the Soviets out. So they had all these, you know, weapons and everything, and there was a big civil war and with all the tribes. And then Taliban consolidated their power through the Wahhabi support from Saudi Arabia. And this is the same religious hardcore fundamentalism that, you know, flew the planes into the towers. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that connection and some of the history there.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, if I gave the impression that Taliban was completely homegrown, you know, that is not correct. I mean, there is a lot of external influence with the Taliban, a lot of it coming from the Pakistan, but also from, you know, from support from al-Qaeda and from the Gulf states. So, you know, it's, as you said, after basically the Taliban really didn't, you know, form up until the, I can't give you the exact date, 92, 93, so about 3 or 4 years after the Soviets were ejected, and when the warlords in Afghanistan started battling, you started having sort of a lawless situation. The Taliban, you know, Mullah Omar, and you know, he formed up a small group in the south, and it you know, they promised to, you know, impose Sharia and keep the law, keep the peace, and all these things, and they did it, and they got support. They used their connections back from the days of the Mujahideen, and got, you know, received, you know, not just that the money was local, as well as they got money from, you know, from prior benefactors. And, you know, and as the movement started growing, the Pakistani inter-service intelligence started encouraging it, backing it, providing it arms and weapons. You know, this became the group that they saw that they would be able to spread their influence within Afghanistan. And the Pakistani military and government has a history of this. All of the jihadi groups that exist to fight India, the Lashkar-e-Taiba and Jaish Muhammad or Harkat Mujahideen, a whole slew of alphabet soup groups, these were all helped, you know, helped to be formed by the Pakistani inter-service intelligence, and in some ways they're, you know, directed or you know, given assistance, and they did the same thing in Afghanistan with the Taliban, and they used funding through the Saudis. They helped the Taliban bring in funding, and the movement just grew and grew, and the next thing you know, they controlled, I believe, you know, at the end of the day, around 90% of the country. The Northern Alliance is squeezed into that small area, and they, you know, again, they went back to their ties with al-Qaeda. You know, there was a split at some point. Al-Qaeda left Afghanistan. It's kind of strange. Just as the Taliban were gaining root, they decided they wanted to go back to the Middle East, and they were in Sudan. They were kicked out from Sudan. they went back to Afghanistan. Mullah Omar welcomed them with open arms, and that's where they developed their training camps that they later used to attack us throughout the world, and, you know, culminating on 9/11.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call, Randolph. We'll take more calls in a moment. Our number, 800-486-8655. Bill Raggio is our guest. He has embedded with the U.S. Marine Corps, the Army, the Iraqi Army, the Iraqi Police, and with the Canadian Army in Afghanistan. He's managing editor of the Long War Journal. He also is a media fellow at the Hoover Institute and a contributor to the Weekly Standard. We're talking about Pakistan and the Pakistanis' military offensive against the Taliban, about the retaliation for that, including yesterday's horrifying news of a suicide bomber at a very prestigious Islamic university in Islamabad in Pakistan. So, join us if you'd like to, or send an email. You can always do that. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio wants to hear from you. Join WPR's new online community, connect with other public radio listeners, and take part in discussions before, during, and even after the show. Go to WPR.org to learn more.
Gail Collins joins us the next hour of our program, op-ed columnist for the New York Times and author of When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Back to phone calls now for Bill Raggio, and we go to Kevin is next from Platteville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Well, I'm surprised how fast I got to the head of the stack.
Yeah. All of a sudden, calls were gone, and now they're all back, and you were at the head of the stack.
Oh, my. Maybe it was lucky. Well, anyway, I'd like to take issue with your guest. On one hand, you know, I'm pro-NRA, and I hate what I will call, you know, simplistic peacenik theology, but he referred to he mentioned prestige, American prestige involved here. And I'm thinking, you know, insofar as considerations, whether or not we should be involved in all that, I'm thinking the whole concept of prestige seems to be so absurd to me when we have, you know, our brave American men coming home maimed, and women coming home maimed and injured. And I'd just like to know that wherever, whatever group he consults with and whatnot, that they try to minimize this concept of prestige. It's got no place in the matter, as far as I know, if I understand the word correctly. I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, Kevin.
Sure. Yeah, look, what I'm referring to there is, you know, perhaps prestige is not the correct word. Maybe reputation may be better. But what I'm talking about here is if Al-Qaeda, if the Taliban perceives us to be what they call the weak horse, they will attack us. And I mean, it is that simple. These are Osama bin Laden's own words. And, you know, so again, once we commit to these types of actions, and again, we can debate all day whether it's a good idea or not, you know, we do have to see them through to some sort of logical end and some sort of end that is going to be beneficial to us in the sense that we are not seen as being weak, so that we do not encourage Al-Qaeda to conduct additional attacks against us and against our interests, both here in the United States and across the world. I mean, and it's not just the conducting attacks as well. When our prestige, when our reputation is damaged, it helps their recruiting, it helps their fundraising. You know, it helps them in ways that really help hurt our cause. I hope that's clear.
Yeah, thanks for the call. And I must ask you, what is it that makes the Taliban attractive to anybody right now? What do they get from it?
The winners. One of the things that the Golden Chain, according to the people that I talk to, they like to back winners. So when Al-Qaeda in Iraq was riding high, all the money was going to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. When Al-Qaeda in Iraq took it on the chin, the funds dried up and they started going into Pakistan and Afghanistan. They like to back, you know, they don't want to invest their money in bad jihad. This is why the funds for the jihad in Chechnya against the Soviet Union, that was all the rage in the 1990s when you had the Chechen Civil War. They had all kinds of money in Chechnya and Bosnia. They're not given money there anymore because those areas have been, because the jihadis in those areas have been by and large defeated. They're not getting their bang, you know, so the investors are not getting their bang for their buck. They want, you know, they want to go, they want to put their money and be able to say, I back that group. I back the Taliban. They're beating the U.S. They're causing a debate in the United States that's making them consider withdrawing.
Mm-hmm. We go next to William from Eagle River. Hi, William.
Yes, good morning. Mr. Raggio seems to forget that I'm not an admirer of the Taliban, but Mr. Raggio seems to forget that under the Taliban, there was zero production of heroin in Afghanistan, and now we have 2,000 tons under our watch, Mr. Raggio. So really, I think your philosophy, the idea that this business of Khorasan, I don't know where you got that from. I can understand why they have shifted to Afghanistan, because we have shifted our powers there, our forces. And also, another point I dispute with him is that the Al-Qaeda took it on the chin in Iraq. What happened in Iraq, Mr. Raggio, is we really hired 100,000 Sunnis at the average of $300 to $400 a month, and that really was to correct the mistake, the idiotic mistake of Mr. Bremer to dismiss the 400,000 Iraqi army. Once we had them on our payroll in Iraq, we had actually peeled them away from Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. So you're totally wrong. Nobody took it on the chin. We just changed, as you said, I think your words, we changed our resources. That was a smart thing to do. It was idiotic to go to Iraq. It has really not given us anything but more fuel for Al-Qaeda successfully to hire more, to recruit more and more and more. And I think Mr. Raggio comes from the background of war. And our country here, the United States, is a great country, but our infrastructure is going down the hill. Our super funds to clean up our environment is dying, and he talks about prestige. Prestige of what?
Bill.
Yeah, sure. I'll take those one at a time. First of all, there was only 1 year of zero opium production in Afghanistan, so there was lots of opium production in the other years. The second thing on the Khorasan, that comes from Al-Qaeda's own propaganda. If you took the time to read it, I post it often. This is also discussed by a lot of Asian authors in the Asia Times, in Dawn, in Daily Times. You know, I like to read the press room over there more than I like to read the New York Times or the Washington Post, because I find it to be more informative and they have better sources over there. As far as Al-Qaeda in Iraq goes, look, I've been to Iraq. I've been to Anbar province where we supposedly bought off the insurgency. That, you know, this is one of the biggest lies that won't die, is that we just bought off the awakening, what's called the Sunni awakening. It's just not true. They turned on Al-Qaeda because Al-Qaeda tried to import a radical brand, a Taliban-like rule into their areas. And what they first thought they saw was, hey, this is a great way to get rid of the Americans. We'll ally with these guys. They saw the errors of their way, and they turned on them. You can go back in the press reporting in 2003, 2004, before we even considered, we even knew what the awakening was and who these people were, and you could see a lot of reports of major clashes between Al-Qaeda and these tribal groups. And it was that, because they were fighting for their lives, they were fighting for the civilization. Yes, the funding was important in helping them succeed. I mean, it helped them buy weapons, it helped them buy ammunition, it helped them pay the people that instead of working jobs, or instead of maybe they would take $100 to lay down an IED on the road, they'd guard their local neighborhoods. But a lot of these groups didn't take money to do this. And as far as, and I already said, Iraq, I wouldn't have agreed to have gone into Iraq. That wouldn't have been you know, that wouldn't. But the reality is once you went there, you had both a moral obligation and you committed to it. You have to, you know, as Colin Powell said, you break it, you bought it. I'm a believer in that. You just can't walk away from these things. We have a moral imperative, and we have strategic considerations.
William, thanks very much for the call. We have about 30 seconds left. What can be done immediately to lessen the security threats in Pakistan, to reopen the schools, et cetera?
Well, the Pakistani military is going to have to do more than just go into South Waziristan. They're going to have to expand their operations into several other tribal agencies and districts, and they're going to have to crack down on this alphabet soup of jihadi groups that are launching these attacks, because what's called the Punjabi Taliban outside of those tribal areas are the ones that raided general headquarters and are conducting a lot of these other attacks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bill, so much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
Our guest, Bill Raggio, he is the managing editor of the Long War Journal. You can go online and get a lot of his reporting. It is in existence to provide accurate and original reporting and analysis of the global war on terror. He's president of Public Multimedia, an adjunct fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a media fellow at the Hoover Institute, and also a contributor to the Weekly Standard. He's been embedded with the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army, the Georgia Army, the Iraqi Army, the Iraqi Police, and with the Canadian Army in Afghanistan. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this program, and thanks to Rob as well for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios this Wednesday. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then another hour of interesting conversation, so stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.